3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. And this is Priya in the studio with Kate. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Priya. How are you this week?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah. I enjoyed a little bit of sunshine throughout the week that we had, that surprise sunshine.
So yeah.
That was always nice.
What did you do?
I did a little bit of work in the park, actually, which, you know, us Melburnians, we've got to make the most of the sun when it comes out.
This is true. I very much struggle to work in the park because I'm always dog watching or possum watching.
Oh, true.
Yeah.
Me too. And secretly hoping that a dog runs over and says hello.
Yeah. And then the owner is like, oh my God, he never does this. There must be something so special about you because he like hates everyone. But he seems to love you. That's my ultimate celebrity moment and still yet to ever happen, where like I'm the special character for someone's pet.
I have hope. I have hope that it will happen.
Thank you. I wasn't even the special character for my own pets. So we have a packed show today and a real variety of topics. So first up, we are going to hear a conversation recorded by Leela on Saturday the 25th of July with Yaron Cousins-Bundle about the process of grounding back in Jabiran country after visiting Mpantwa Desert Country the week before to stand in solidarity with Auntie Felicity and the Hayes family demanding sacred Aranda land back at the Pine Gap Convergence.
Then we will speak with Rodrigo Acuña, who is a Spanish teacher, documentary filmmaker, and independent specialist in Latin American affairs. We're going to speak with Rodrigo about his recent attendance at the Independent and Peaceful Australian Network's National Conference, some themes that were brought up, what he spoke about, including Latin American representation within Australian media, and whether or not Australia's relationship with the US impacts this coverage.
Ah, well, very interesting. I would say yes. After that, we are going to be joined by Tom Cooper, chair of the 44 Flats United 150 Inkerman Street Residents Committee. And Tom is joining us again to speak about an action that's been planned by residents across at least four of the older persons' high-rise public housing buildings that have been slated for demolition by the Victorian government to bring their concerns to the office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos next Wednesday. Now, this is going to include residents between the ages of 55 and 100 bringing their petitions to the office. So please stay tuned to listen to that.
Next, we have Chris Christofferou, CEO of VADA, Victoria Alcohol and Drug Association, joining us to outline what the organisation would like to see from political parties as we approach state elections. Now, we will consider current alcohol and drug treatment services that are available, evidence-based policies that prioritise a health-led approach, and gaps in the Victorian government's current drug and alcohol strategy.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how things shape up now with the new premier. And I wonder if that'll have any consequences for how the platform is put forward. Mm. And finally, we'll be joined by Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria to talk about the group's recent publication of a jointly authored statement alongside some of Victoria's leading health and justice organisations urging the Australian Press Council to adopt ethical guidelines for journalists and commentators reporting on homelessness in the wake of a really derogatory opinion piece by commentator and former shock jock Steve Price in the Herald Sun. So really looking forward to that conversation. I feel like, you know, corporate media and even public media doesn't often provide people genuinely with the right of reply, and especially when it comes to communities that are made marginal, as homeless folks are. This is a structural condition. It is rare to be able to get that same audience to then listen to the perspectives of the people that are affected by these kinds of narratives. So stay tuned. We are with you all the way through to 8:30 this morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
Hello, good morning again. You're on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 30th of July. Asylum seekers held on Nauru by the federal government have urged the government to urgently address food and water shortages, electricity blackouts, and uncertainty over their futures after more than 2 years in offshore detention. The Refugee Action Coalition reports there are real concerns about the safety of the drinking water from the rain tanks, and many asylum seekers are surviving on one meal per day.
Also in headlines, a High Court challenge was brought against the Queensland government this week, challenging laws that ban pro-Palestine freedom phrases. Human rights experts and activists argue the restrictions unlawfully disrupt freedom of political communication and breach the Constitution. Those bringing the case to the High Court include Palestinian, Jewish, and First Nations people, including four people who have been arrested or faced police action over the banned phrases. The challenge seeks to have the laws struck down, with one plaintiff, Rimanaji, saying, quote, "We should all be free to denounce the deliberate killing, maiming, and starvation of innocent Palestinians, and we will continue to protest until the genocide stops and those responsible are held to account," end quote.
In other news, hundreds of health workers rallied outside the Health Practitioner Regulation Agency in Gadigal Country, Sydney, this week, condemning its adoption of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. The IHRA definition is widely rejected by human rights and freedom of speech experts because, among other issues, it conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Protesting health practitioners argue adoption of the definition by the Health Practitioner Regulation Agency could silence criticism of Israel and pro-Palestine advocacy, including widespread condemnation from workers of Israel's destruction of Gaza's healthcare system.
Also in news this week, new national data has established the first Indigenous-led national baseline for measuring progress on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, identifying 177 languages currently spoken or used nationally and 113 undergoing revival. The survey found 24 languages had no speakers or users under the age of 20, highlighting the ongoing oppression and disruption of First Nations languages by colonization. Experts say the baseline findings highlight both the strength of First Nations languages and the extraordinary work communities are undertaking to revitalize them.
In environmental news, authorities have confirmed the first local transmission of H5 bird flu between wild birds, after genetic testing indicated the virus had spread among greater crested terns in South Australia. 27 cases have now been detected across four states, with authorities warning the virus is likely to spread further among wildlife. The virus has not been found in poultry or agricultural industries and currently poses a low risk to human health.
And finally, in headlines, there has been a death in custody of an 18-year-old woman at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre on Monday, the 27th of July this year. Now, Flat Out put out a brief statement sending love and solidarity to those in the community, especially those who are currently or formerly incarcerated, and expressed that they were devastated by the news. And they have been asking some important questions about how a young woman is able to die in the so-called care of the state. Now, people will be continuing to rally and fight for justice, and we encourage people to follow Flat Out on Instagram or head to their website to follow this story, because undoubtedly there will be a push for justice, accountability, and more news so that the community can rally around amplify this grievous miscarriage of justice. Now, these have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 30th of July. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Are you ready to get lost in science this National Science Week? We'll join the Lost in Science team for our annual Trivia Night extravaganza at the Birmingham Hotel. Hop, skip and a jump away from 3CR on the corner of Smith and Johnson Streets in Fitzroy. Presented by the Lost in Science team with new and old science questions across a range of topics, picture rounds, group activities and prizes big and small to be won by you and your team. At the Burmy, corner of Smith and Johnson Streets, Fitzroy. That date again, Monday, 17th of August. To get your tickets, you can look up Lost in Science Trivia 2026 online or head to 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au. Get lost in science during National Science Week.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:11 in the morning, and we are now going to listen to a conversation that was recorded by Thursday Breakfast presenter Leela on Saturday, the 25th of July, with Yaron Cousins-Bundle. Now, Leela and Yaron spoke about the process of Yaron's grounding back in Jabiran country after visiting Bantwa Desert country the week before to stand in solidarity with Auntie Felicity and the Hayes family, demanding sacred Aranda land back at the Pine Gap Convergence. Yaron describes how her old girls, ancestors living through country, received her return to sacred country with pride and unpacks how the decolonial work on her ancestral lands is interwoven with the work of liberatory justice for kin across the continent and expanding globally. You will hear waterways, land, animals and sky joining in the conversation along the way.
My name is Yaron Cousins-Bundle. I'm a proud Jabiran woman, Bengal. I also belong to the Gunjmara nation to the south, my mother's people, and the Yuin nations of so-called New South Wales, and the Bidjara nation of so-called Queensland, and that's my father's lines. And so I'm sitting here with one of our kin, one of our ancestral trees on our sacred songline up on Jabiran country, and this part of Jabiran country is very, very significant. We're sitting on the Naram Naram.
Yeah.
And this Naram Naram is part of the birthing creation country that weaves through the different clan countries that make up Jabiran country. And it's a real honour and privilege to be home and be sitting here, you know, with my ancestors. And after journeying back from Mopante up on Aranda country, there's a big story to tell here.
Do you want to talk a bit about how, what happened last night and the meaning behind that ceremony and grounding from the desert land back to the forest and the river?
Yeah, it was exactly like that, is going, journeying to a different mob's country and paying deep respects to their sacred lands, their peoples, their law, their other kin on country. It's a hard thing to describe in English about those connections that all of our mobs have, and that understanding of each other's, you know, place of belonging, and coming home, coming from the desert mob country back to Jabiran country, there had to be that grounding and that homecoming. Culturally and spiritually as much as physically. And so last night a group of beautiful allies in solidarity supported me to go back to the women's ceremony ground and sit and be present. And I had this energy that I wanted to, you know, share in a smoking and a cleansing of our connection, our reconnection back to that site, and how that site was decolonized by us Japurung women, and how we took that back in ceremony and law. And after the Japurung embassy camps were removed by VicPol.
When was that? Was that?
So in 2022, when the Japurung embassy camps were removed, everything that we were connected to was removed from our country by VicPol and VicRoads. But the only thing that remained, that no one went near, no one touched nothing on, it was our women's ceremony ground.
Yeah.
And it remains strong there today. And last night, coming home, relighting the fire, my old girls tested me. You know, they were giving me that auntie's yarn, that they miss me, that I'd been away from home for too long.
Yeah, I know the one.
And I had to earn it. Yeah. And they're saying, where you been?
Yeah.
And they say, we know where you been, but we're glad you're home now.
Yeah.
And yeah. And they, oh, it was really hard to not get emotional, because they were so proud of me. And before the last 3 years, after the camps were removed, me and my babies walked this sacred country. We lived out in Pomono, out on Werepkort Balag clan country. It was also strong Naram Naram. We lived on the Naram Naram. And I believe that the country and them old girls gave me my youngest child, Ware.
Yeah.
And her name is Ware, is the ocean.
Oh, that's beautiful.
But it's in Japurung.
Yeah.
So that means a long, long time ago, the ocean was here.
Yeah.
On the sand country. It's part of the eastern, the Japurung side of Gariwerd. It's sandy. There's big sand dunes, and they're part of our burial grounds as well. You know, which sadly, the local greedies, you know, it's bad enough that the farmers have completely decimated the country by misuse and not enough knowledge of the natural resource and how to really care for this country and thrive on it.
Yeah.
They, you know, there's a local farmer down on the Naram Naram that wants to mine our burial sand dunes. Sand mine.
Yeah.
So these, you know, this is one of the reasons why we have to stand ground. One of the reasons why we have to stand ground now, because ever since the Japurung embassy camps were created by my brother and his wife at the time, and family all come, and we understood the significance not only of the sacred landscape, but the significance of the fight, the sovereign inherent cultural birthrights that if we don't uphold now, the federal government and other groups that oppress us, you know, they're gaining ground in that regard, you know?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, for people that might not know yet, maybe mob up in Mpantwa, could you talk a bit about, you mentioned they wanted to, you know, people are looking to mine some of the Jabarung land. Can you talk more about some of the threats that this birthing country has been facing and what you're doing right now, what's called you to this place again right now to fight and revisit.
Yeah. Naram Naram has endured so much already. Our sacred creation or country, the place of birthing trees and sacred songlines that connect nations. And we're sitting here on one right now. So the threats to our entire cultural identity and being physically living back on country are at major threat. All the other threats to the Naram Naram come from the white man, and they come from our government, and they come from these corporations and these people that are just doing their job. At the end of the day, their job is complicit in cultural genocide, and they're the ones actively genociding our sacred country. And what they don't realise is that our sacred country is us. We are country. We are so intrinsically connected that these threats are upon us as well. We have rare earth mineral mining, mass, you know, a huge mass mine. When we have a statewide ban on uranium, there's been this huge mass mine approved for rare earth minerals on Wotjobaluk country, which is our neighbour mob, our northwestern neighbour, who also is our family clan kinship way to Gariward.
Yeah.
So there's sand mines that are threatening our sacred burial grounds on the Naram Naram. They're threatening burial trees with bones in them. They've been there long, long time, and they should never be disturbed.
Yeah.
And the birthing trees, the placental trees, the DNA of our women and children is all over this Naram Naram. And yeah. I laugh sometimes, you know, when I think about the size of the fight that we have to endure. But I laugh to myself and I look at the Maripa and I say, hey, they can never remove our DNA from this land, no matter how much they try. And I have two daughters, one whom was born onto this sacred Naram Naram, that I was blessed to still feel this deep gratitude to country for gifting me one of the most beautiful star child elders of our time. I definitely felt like I could fight for this country for the rest of my breathing days. But since I had my daughters, I knew that I had to be the remedy. I had to be...
Take that responsibility.
Yeah, the connection, but it's more than our cultural responsibility.
Yeah.
It's the skin, the cultural skin that we're born into, and the family bloodlines of where we belong on country. And so there are these deep family cultural obligations, but there's also something that is part of creation business, which does encompass the sorry business as well.
Mm.
The big cycle of life. But that side of it, when you're bringing life, you're singing life into country, that is all that we need to do.
Yeah.
And we need everybody to support us so we can sing our songs again. And when our songs are strong, so will our people, so will our country. And there'll be absolutely nothing that any of the police forces, the army, the government, anybody can do that. Because if they had the means to break us down, they would have already. And we are not a threat to this colony. We are the medicine.
That was a beautiful conversation between Yaron Cousins Bundle and Leela from the Thursday Breakfast program, recorded on Saturday, the 25th of July, talking about the process of Yaron's grounding back in Jabiran country after visiting Bantwa Desert Country the previous week to stand in solidarity with Auntie Felicity and the Hayes family, who were demanding sacred Aranda land back at the Pine Gap Convergence. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:26 in the morning.
Okay, and now on air we have Rodrigo Acuña, who is a Spanish teacher, documentary filmmaker, and independent specialist in Latin American affairs. Rodrigo has been writing on Latin American politics for more than 20 years, and in 2024 completed his first documentary film, Venezuela, The Cost of Challenging an Empire. Today, Rodrigo joins us to speak about his time at the Independent and Peaceful Australian Network's National Conference, what was spoken about and what he spoke about. So, Rodrigo, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you recently attended and spoke alongside many other wonderful speakers at the Independent and Peaceful Australian Network National Conference. The theme of the conference was Time to Break Free from the US. I was wondering if you could tell us what some of the topics were touched on by speakers throughout the day.
There were many, many topics, but essentially the theme of the conference was looking at the alliance with the United States, the AUKUS agreement, and what Australia is actually getting out of that agreement. And a lot of the speakers focused on the issue of the submarines, the nuclear submarines. So just the environmental consequences of having or accepting such a project, the reality that Australia might not even get its own submarines based on the shortages that the United States has, or how it's attempting to replace its own naval vessels, and just the environmental impact of having U.S. bases in the country that was discussed. And I think finally the fact that China has never publicly perceived there is no serious evidence that China has declared that Australia is a threat to its national security. So we are making ourselves a target with our alliance with the United States. And a lot of very qualified speakers were there and presented considerable information. It was one of the most informative conferences I have ever attended, and I've attended quite a few.
I'm just wondering if it was a coincidence that the conference was held a day before 26th of July, the National Rebellion Day in Cuba.
I think that was more of a coincidence. Mm-hmm, it was just the timing. I don't think there was anything behind that date.
I read that one wrong, that's for sure.
I mean, maybe you read it right, but I wasn't informed about anything to do with Cuba.
Now, in your speech, you spoke at the conference, and in your speech, you mentioned that Latin America receives minimal attention by the Australian media. I was wondering if you could outline why you think this is, and what are your thoughts on the coverage that does exist?
Well, I think in general the coverage is almost non-existent. And when coverage is available, it's generally just going by the media outlets from the United States, the wires, the US wires. And again, there's nothing really in depth there. There have been some exceptions. I mentioned that in the speech, the case of Adriana Rivas when she was arrested here in Sydney. She's a former Pinochet intelligence agent. She's accused of torture and murder and was on the run from Chilean authorities and eventually was arrested. And the case of the declassification of ASIS files, Australian government files, of Australia's foreign intelligence agency and their involvement in the overthrow of Salvador Allende in 1973. That was in collaboration with the CIA. So I think those two stories received a lot of coverage. But in general, the region is ignored. And what I mentioned in my talk is I think that the reasons are because the United States generally looks quite terrible. It comes off quite terrible because of its long history of interventionism in the region. So take, for example, the recent elections in Colombia. U.S. Senators were making statements supporting the hard right in the country. There's a very long history of the United States intervening, whether it's their local ambassador or members of the U.S. government or senators making statements in support of certain candidates or just openly throwing money at them. So when you start looking at that, if you were to do some sort of serious reporting on those issues, again, our great ally doesn't come off really well. And the other thing that I mentioned in my talk is that there's a lot of inspiration taking place in the region. So there's a lot of examples of people organizing themselves against insurmountable odds and at times winning. And that's something that is really empowering when you take into consideration the long history of trade unions in Latin America, the long history of people's mobilizations, grassroots organizations, women's organizations, indigenous organizations. And I think if more stories came out of the region highlighting the role that these people and these organizations play, then I think a lot more people would be informed, but also quite possibly become empowered.
Yeah, and you sort of mentioned, I guess, sort of narratives or strategies or tactics or things like that perhaps Australian folks could be missing out on by not hearing about these news stories. And so I guess are you aware of sort of what some existing ties between Latin America and Australian groups and solidarity exist?
Oh, there are many. There are many ties and links. They're just on a smaller scale. But take, for example, the cases of Nicaragua and Cuba. In Nicaragua in the 1980s or 1979, there was a very popular widespread revolution that took place. US-backed dictator was overthrown. And for about 10 years, the Sandinistas were in power. Now, today, they're a very different animal, but what they were, what they looked like back in the 1980s, they were certainly much more democratic. And you had a lot of Australians going over there and working in support of that revolution, whether it was teachers helping out with their literacy program, or nurses or doctors, or political activists. There were people travelling to the country and trying to kind of make contributions to society. And the situation in Cuba, again, like Nicaragua, had a very brutal dictator, US-backed dictator that was overthrown. And the country has suffered probably the most rigorous sanctions regime by a larger power imposed on a smaller state in history. Mm. And there have been Australians that have been going over to Cuba and trying to help the society as they see fit in order to try and lessen the impact of those sanctions. So there are many examples. You just have to look for them.
Mm. Yeah, and I imagine, if coverage was a little bit more expanded, then perhaps there could be even more. And now I wanted to turn to your work that you did on the documentary at Venezuela, The Cost of Challenging an Empire. I was wondering, Like, if you could tell us a little bit about that and then give us a bit of a read on, you know, what's currently happening within Venezuela and maybe where you feel that situation has not been covered, you know, maybe to the best that it can be within Australian media.
Certainly. So Venezuela saw a former military lieutenant colonel win democratic elections in 1999. And from 1999 to 2003, when Hugo Chavez died of cancer, he was in power and there were a lot of positive things happening. There were not everything was obviously positive, but there were a lot more positives, I would say, than negatives. And what were the positives? Well, the positives were that the government engaged in construction of a massive housing program where people of lower income and middle income could either end up buying these properties or they were given these properties for free. And that was something that was incredible because of the amount of people that either lived in terrible dwellings or were homeless. And you could see that. I mean, if you've traveled to Venezuela, I have on numerous occasions, these buildings are everywhere. They're not just a small block of flats in some part of the city and then that's the sort of the model that's put on state TV. No, they are actually everywhere around the country. It was a massive program. And the same thing could be said for the programs in literacy and health, massive expansion, their sports programs. The Venezuelans have performed better under or since 1999 at the Olympics than they had the previous 100 years. They won more medals under the Chavez and the Maduro government than any other government. And that was because there was an investment, a serious investment in this popular sports program. So all of these things that I've witnessed throughout the years of my travels in Venezuela generally would never receive any sort of serious coverage. I mean, you would think that the government was just handing out a couple of chickens at a fair on a Sunday, and that was its poverty reduction programs. Wasn't actually the case. So I, together with a journalist called Nicholas Ford, we got together and we decided to travel to Venezuela, do some filming, and show some of these programs, but also the impact of U.S. economic sanctions. We talked to numerous experts. We talked to members of the opposition as well, and we put that together in this very small little film called Venezuela, The Cost of Challenging an Empire. Now, we finished our filming late 2022-23. We released the film in late 2024. Mm-hmm. And since then, obviously, earlier this year, the United States went into Venezuela and I think under quite bogus charges, captured Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, the president. Wife and first lady. And the country is now run by interim president Delcy Rodriguez, who has allowed the government's all of the payments for oil revenues that the government's meant to receive. Those payments are now going directly to the U.S. government. So the U.S. government is administering all of the oil sales that Venezuela makes, and then it relays that money back to Venezuela. Now, when they carried out that attack and they captured Maduro and Flores, they actually told the remaining government officials that if they did not comply with the United States and their dictates, that another round of bombing was going to take place, and if necessary, a third round of bombing. So you can understand why they decided to make the concessions they have. But in that process, what's resulted is that the country has effectively lost its sovereignty. Mm. Venezuela is no longer a sovereign country. If you're allowing a foreign power to control your economy, then again, you're not a sovereign state. You're a colony, and that's unfortunately what has been taking place in Venezuela. Now, in the long term, or even in the medium term, this means that there is going to be a backlash. I think it's very hard for there not to be a backlash from certain sectors of the population, particularly the ones that enjoyed the housing programs, the healthcare programs, the sports programs, all of the policies that the government was previously investing its oil resources or revenue into. I don't see those policies continuing because the United States, again, they're controlling their the revenues from the oil industry.
Yes, and I guess if money is being invested into the population and in terms of health and education, then that's less money that can be capitalized upon by the United States.
Well, exactly, and it just goes directly in contrast to the political economic philosophy that the United States has been promoting for the last 40, 50 years, which is that the private sector needs to have the biggest control of the economy, and the state sector needs to be reduced, and things like education and health, et cetera, they're almost a nuisance. I mean, they've got the former wife of the WWE or WWF, whatever it's called, the Wrestling Federation, in charge of the Department of Education in the country. I mean, a woman with no experience in education, running the education program and effectively attempting to dismantle the education system. So very that's concerning. Where the United States, exactly.
And as we wrap up, Rodrigo, I was wondering if you could just shed a little bit of light on what you're currently working on, and if people wanted to engage with your work, how could they do so?
So I've got a website. I'm across a lot of social media as well. I have, so you can visit my website, just the rodrigoacuna.com. I have a newsletter, a bi-monthly newsletter that I produce, and that's available to the public on Patreon. It's available for free. If they want to support the work, they can support the work economically as well. And that in that newsletter, I basically summarize political developments in Latin America, or attempt to summarize political developments in Latin America. And I also talk about my own work. I've also contributed a chapter to a book which is going to be published later this year. It's an open letter to Donald Trump, looking at Donald Trump's record in Latin America. And that's edited by the Uruguayan-Australian novelist Natalia Barroso Figueroa. She's a wonderful new author of a new book. And that's going to be coming out later this year. And you can also find my writings in Truth Out. Again, just subscribe to the newsletter and you'll be able to keep track of what I'm doing.
Amazing. I am definitely keeping my eye out for that letter to Donald Trump. That would be very interesting, Rodrigo. And, well, thank you so much for being on the show and also for continuing your great work on trying to get Latin American studies and issues out further, throughout this country.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Have a great day.
You too.
And you were listening to Rodrigo Acuña, who is a Spanish teacher, documentary filmmaker, and independent specialist in Latin American affairs. He has written extensively on Latin American politics and also completed a documentary on Venezuela. Yes, if you wanted to engage with any of his fantastic work, we will put links up on our show notes. And now over to our next beautiful guests.
In a minute. We will jump to a couple of announcements now, but it is 7:43 in the morning. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are looking forward to taking you through all the way to 8:30. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 PM on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial podcast. Streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR Digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are now joined by Tom Cooper, Chair of the 44 Flats United 150 Inkerman Street Residents Committee. And Tom is speaking with us about an action planned by residents across at least four of the older persons' high-rise public housing buildings that have been slated for demolition by the Victorian government to bring their concerns to the Office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos next Wednesday. Residents aged between 55 and 100 are inviting Minister Stakos to receive their petitions against the planned demolition of their homes, and they'll be bringing the message directly to the minister at 1 Spring Street at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 5th of August. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Priya.
Thank you very much for joining us. I am delighted to be able to speak with you again because I remember the first time that we had you on the program was on the 23rd of April this year, and we were speaking at a much earlier stage of the resident committee formation. So can you talk a bit about what that process has been like to establish the 150 Inkerman Street Residents Committee?
Sure thing. Yeah, well, we had the election. First off, we just asked everybody if they wanted to go or stay. They were being told that they had to relocate, and the vast majority of people signed a petition to say that they would definitely want to stay and maintain our place, our home, our community. And so we had an election and elected the committee in, and we meet every Monday. Community events, meals and music events. But there's action that's coming up on Wednesday is a big one because it's the petitions that have happened at our estate and Inkerman Street and Albert Park and Kensington and Flemington.
Mm.
And everybody's welcome to come because it's a big occasion at 1 o'clock at number 1 Spring Street. To hopefully meet the new Housing Minister, Nick Stakos.
Yeah.
The petitions.
Yeah, I mean, it is... it's a big occasion because I don't think... At least, you know, in my memory, I can't think of another time where we've seen this kind of action, you know, sort of descending on the housing minister that is being led by residents of older persons' high-rise towers. So can you talk about what that sort of means?
Well, it's amazing because it's actually the people who are really, really involved having a voice and having a powerful voice because our lives depend on it, keeping our home and keeping our community it's vital. It's, you can't just walk away from it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is sort of one of those moments where you get to really viscerally present what the stakes are of losing this housing and losing the communities that you live in to the minister. Have you had any communications with the new housing minister, at, you know, as 44 Flats United or as the Inkerman Street Residents Committee before this?
No.
And so this will be the first opportunity for him to really hear directly from residents about how they feel.
Absolutely. I really hope he takes the opportunity. We've said to him, invited him to come and see us and said it will be seen as a snub if he doesn't show up in person because people go to a lot of trouble coming as they do from different places in different ages and different states of health and strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, on that point, I was, you know, really struck by the fact that it would be folks up to the age of 100 coming. What's it been like to sort of organise this action and to make sure everyone can get there?
With taxis and getting people with making sure that people have got assistance. we had a big meeting on Monday at the Fitzroy Town Hall where people came from, I think, 15 different places. I know with ours, we'd book cabs and stuff, and they cancelled at the last minute, and that was a bit of a bum fight. But we managed to get there about 5 minutes late. So you've got just people who are in it well into their 90s at Inkerman Street, climbing into the back seat of a taxi, maxi taxi.
And it's no small thing to make this effort to get to the minister. So I can absolutely understand, you know, what you said previously about this being considered a snub if the minister chooses not to engage. But, you know, thinking towards the future after this action, you know, what are your plans to continue building resident organizing amongst the older persons' high rises? Are there other residents' committees? Is Inkerman Street the first and only residents' committee?
No. We were the first, but we were closely followed by Albert Park and Kensington and Flemington. And they've all got their committees. It's a very exciting time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's I believe it was 7 out of the 13 older persons' high rises that have been formally scheduled for demolition. So hopefully this will inspire folks at other older persons' high rises and folks across the city to get involved and start thinking about what they want for their homes and for their future. Now, Tom, is there anything else that you want to share with us about this process? Any reflections on what the organizing has been like or anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
I'll pray just that the two decision makers are the new Premier and the new Minister of Housing. So whatever pressure can be put on them, it's really important. I'd just like everybody to come on Wednesday at 1 o'clock to Spring Street for starters. At the moment, we're just really resolute to just stay where we are. This is our home, and if push comes to shove, I know that all supporters of public housing will come together from many different sources.
Yeah, I really, really encourage people to get along on Wednesday and to hear firsthand from folks who are in the older persons' high-rises about why this housing is so vital and about their desire to stay in the homes that they are already in that have been, for a lot of people, very hard to access but have provided such an amazing foundation for stability and ability to age well.
Yeah, lovely lady, Laker. She's 93 years old, and you know, she waited 10 years before she could get into public housing, and the day that she did go into her unit that she's in now for the last 25 years, that first day she just went, oh, goodness, thank you so much to the Australian government. She just felt so grateful, and she said, what am I supposed to think now? What am I supposed to say to the government that want to take it away? But I'd say that any move to shift people out of their public housing and any excuse or reason that's given is absolute and total garbage, and it's rubbish, and it shouldn't be... no one should feel afraid of the proposal. Just say it's garbage and it's unworthy.
Mm. So, yeah. And that, you know, people need to listen to those who are immediately affected and worst affected and will be will have their lives changed irrevocably if this is to go ahead. So,
Priya, our lives depend on this. You know, community is so important. You know, there's about 30 elderly Russian people, you know, but you can imagine being scattered, their community, you know. All of us, we depend on each other. We work together. It's really good.
Yeah, that is, it's beautiful, and also it is life-sustaining for people in these public housing communities. And I think that's definitely a point that I hope that the minister is able to understand from next week. So thank you so much, Tom. And
thank you for this opportunity, Priya.
Of course. Congratulations on being elected as chair, and well done on all of your efforts. And I look forward to continuing this conversation and hope that many people show up on Wednesday.
Terrific.
Thank you. Bye.
I expect to win.
I expect that you will win.
Yep.
All right. Take care. And that was Tom Cooper, chair of the 44 Flats United 150 Inkerman Street Residents Committee, talking about an action plan by residents across at least four of the older person's high-rise public housing buildings in Albert Park, at Inkerman Street, in Flemington and in North Melbourne that have been slated for demolition by the Victorian government. And they'll be bringing their concerns to the office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos next Wednesday, the 5th of August at 1 p.m. at number 1 Spring Street. And they're asking as many people as possible to come along and stand in solidarity. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
This fascist group thing, evil men with racist views, spreading all across the land.
They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah.
Yena Pasaran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It's 8:04 and we are now joined by Chris Christofferou, CEO of VADA, Victoria Alcohol and Drug Association, to speak with us about their campaigns as we approach state elections. Chris, it is fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you for being here.
Hello, Kate.
So, that was very loud, folks. I'm very sorry I got excited. As we approach state elections, VADA is calling on political parties to properly fund alcohol and drug treatments across the state. What is the demand like for treatment, and how has the Victorian government been travelling in regards to its targets for treatment wait times?
There's been a growing demand for treatment over the last 5 years. Demand, according to data from services across Victoria, shows that there's been 115% increase in wait times. In people waiting for treatment. So, you know, it was in 2020, it was about 2,300, and our most recent survey showed that there were 5,100 people waiting for treatment on any given day in May. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure on services at the moment to meet demand, a lot of blockages in the system. People just aren't getting through quick enough when they're putting up their hand and saying, I need help. So that's an issue, and that's why we're calling for immediate investment to address that gap.
Yeah, that's a major increase upon a figure that perhaps really wasn't that great to begin with, right? And in terms of current alcohol and drug treatments that are available, are there discrepancies between what is accessible in urban areas versus what is accessible in regional areas?
Yeah, look, it's pretty much a patchwork system. So there are some major gaps in regional Victoria, particularly around sort of specialist treatment types like withdrawal services, addiction medicine capability. So that means that people often in country, rural and regional communities can't get place-based services. They often have to travel long distances to get the help that they need to either withdraw off drugs or maintain maintain their medications as part of their treatment and recovery plan. So, that obviously isn't good enough. I mean, it's important that people can get the healthcare that they need in their communities. And, big focus for us, I guess, in the lead up to the state election is to really highlight the gaps that exist in regional parts of the state.
Mm. And I also understand that as part of VADA's campaign, it's encouraging political parties to follow evidence-based policies and prioritise a health-led approach to alcohol and drug treatments and solutions. I understand to achieve this that VADA has recommended a multi-pronged approach. I was wondering if you could shed some light on what this entails.
Yeah, I think you can't really have a, you do need to be, when you're sort of talking alcohol and other drugs, you need to understand first that the use of alcohol and other drugs is a social issue. And approach it through that lens. And obviously when it becomes a problem, when people develop dependency, that it becomes a health issue. So for us, making sure that people are as safe as possible, they have the best information available to them about what might be circulating in the community, what harms particular types of substances do is really important. So prevention and early intervention is really important, a really important part of the system. As is, of course, treatment for those who need it and harm reduction for those that are, to keep people as safe as possible when they are using substances. So, when we talk how do we approach the issue, it's, we need to be focusing on, treatment capacity, of course, but also harm reduction measures that are really integral to trying to sort of keep people as safe as possible, because we know that people will use drugs. Mm. We know that people use alcohol extensively. For some groups, the harms that it causes are really quite profound. So, it's really important that, we're sort of taking a health first approach to these issues. And, and that's why as well we've sort of, really sort of prioritising as well a discussion around decriminalisation, because we know that that's a barrier for people seeking help early because of stigma associated with particularly illicit substance use.
Mm, yeah, definitely. And VADA has also recommended the implementation of a Victorian alcohol and other drug industry plan by 2028. What would this involve, and how would this address gaps in the existing Victorian government's alcohol and other drugs strategy?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on social services in terms of recruiting the right skills. There's been a big growth in the care economy nationally. It's a big part of our workforce. And, we're in a competitive space for skills, expertise and talent. Our sector struggles in some regards to attract and retain people. The material rewards for working in our sector are often less than someone can earn in other spaces. So, for example, there can often be a 30% gap between what someone might earn working in AOD against, say, working in mental health. Mm. That's obviously not sustainable at all. And people that work in AOD are working often with extreme levels of complexity and dealing with trauma, so it requires not just commitment, but upskilling and particular types of expertise. And that's why I think an industry plan is essential. We need to be growing our own. We need sort of pathways into our sector for those that are interested in working in alcohol and other drugs. But also we need more investment in a peer-based workforce. So a lot of people, our own sort of research shows that over 90% of people that work in our sector have identify as having a lived or living experience of alcohol and other drugs. And yet, we just don't have enough designated roles for peers. And that's a really important part of ensuring that, when you do need help, that you're often your first point of contact, and some of your support is someone who's probably gone through a similar experience. So, we need those types of skills, but we also need more addiction medicine specialists and nurses, and I think that an industry plan will help us understand what's required, but also how to put a proper value on those skills as part of a sustainable system.
Yeah, that's sort of on par with funding for, as you said, mental health and other health initiatives, because, you can't separate health from AOD treatments. So to wrap up, I wanted to ask, as we listen to debates about drug and alcohol policies in the lead up to elections, is there anything in particular we should be wary of or know about to help us better understand debates?
Yeah. Look, I think there's been some really great progress over the over the current term of this government. I mean, there's, we've got our first alcohol and other drug strategy for a long, long time. So it's sort of creating a bit of a cohesive narrative of what we're all trying to achieve in terms of the sector, in terms of the broader health system, in terms of justice, in terms of, and more broadly, the Department of Health. So I think it's really important to build on that. But again, I think some of the pressure points that are being experienced and the cost that that's creating, including fatalities, I think is something that we just can't wait for. We can't wait for change. We need it to happen sooner rather than later. And we're hoping that political parties who are contesting the upcoming state election really sort of think about that and commit to, prioritising addressing some of the increasing harms that we're seeing in the community.
Yeah, thank you for being on the show. It's been fantastic speaking with you.
Thank you, Kate.
That was Chris Christopher, CEO of VADA, Victoria Alcohol and Drug Association, and he joined us to speak about some of VADA's campaigns and initiatives in the lead up to state elections at the end of this year.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
The People's Record is a podcast that looks at race, policing, and public housing. Over 5 episodes, we speak with residents, lawyers, academics, and activists about how policing has evolved and public housing communities are targeted. Listen to us on 3CR in August.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and this is the final interview for our show today. And we are so glad to be joined in the studio by Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria to talk about the group's recent publication of a jointly authored statement alongside some of Victoria's leading health and justice organisations, urging the Australian Press Council to adopt ethical standards and guidelines for journalists and commentators reporting on homelessness. Now, this statement was issued following the recent publication of an opinion piece by commentator and former shock jock Steve Price in the Herald Sun that featured really harmful representations of people experiencing homelessness and poor health in Melbourne CBD. The Homeless Persons Union of Victoria is calling for the Australian Press Council to adopt the Council to Homeless Persons Media Messaging Guide, which you can read in the links to that we'll be putting in our show notes. And we will also include a link in our show notes for how you can make your own complaint to the Australian Press Council. But for now, good morning, Danny and Kelly.
Good morning, Priya.
Good morning, Priya. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming in. Our listeners can't hear this, but I want them to know that we are all standing up because this is such an important conversation. Now, Kelly, I want to go to you first. As a founding member of the Homeless Persons Union, you have had over a decade of experience challenging incorrect assumptions about and representations of the homeless community. And over this time, have you noticed any shifts in the way that homelessness is reported on in the Australian media landscape?
Yeah, I guess when we cast our mind back to years around like 2016, 2017, when we were quite active, newspapers, the ones that we kind of think of when we think about kind of bad reporting, they were often using the pets issue. The pets issue was a really big deal. Like there were a lot of people that had their pet doggies on the streets of the CBD, and the lines were always, how can they afford to keep their pets when they can't even afford food or whatever, or they're using their pets to make money, the pets are being used, the pets are being exploited. That was a really big deal back in the day. Also, there used to be a lot of lines around how resilient people are, they're so tenacious to survive on the streets. And now fast forward 10 years, people are being called smelly. And why aren't they taking housing? They're knocking back housing. So it's kind of gone back to, I think in the intervening years and the years in between, there was a focus on the systemic drivers of homelessness, like the forces that push people into homelessness. And now it's kind of come back a bit to the personal again, but it's very mixed. It's very mixed depending on the publication. And lastly, I'll just say, I think homelessness now by a lot of right-wing papers is used as a bit of clickbait. It's a flashpoint to talk about like a law and order approach. And unfortunately, our local councils have followed suit with disastrous consequences for people.
Yeah, well, I think the clickbait point is such an important one. And, you know, I don't want to send any more clicks Steve Price's way or ask you to repeat any of the language. It was quite offensive in his piece. But I did want to ask you both about the visual aspect of the article, because that's a big part of clickbait as well. And peppered through that piece are a couple of really disturbing photographs that depict people sleeping rough in quite appalling ways. And even though their faces are not visible, I want to ask, is that really enough to say that these photos are appropriate to use in reporting? You know, what about consent? And what role do these negative visual depictions of homelessness play when it comes to shaping public perceptions?
Yeah, so I guess in our view, it doesn't matter that their faces were blurred. So photographing people who are often in crisis without their informed consent is inherently exploitative, which is against one of the guidelines that the Australian Press Council publishes on their website. But in this case, it's even more so because those pictures were accompanied by language intended to invite ridicule rather than respectful analysis of the drivers of homelessness. As Kelly said, that's really important when we're talking about these issues. And I just think we need to remember that those sleeping rough are some of the most oppressed and marginalised people in our society, and they deserve to be treated with dignity and care by all of us, and that includes journalists. So it really does shape how we think about these issues, hence why we think it's so important to raise this issue.
Yeah. And I'll just quickly add, Priya, that looking into that article a bit more deeply, they're all stock images. Like, they're not even associated with people that he was talking about at the time. They've been taken by like three or four different photographers employed by the Herald Sun over time. And yes, images are very powerful. They grab attention. They do shape consciousness. And we think it's a bit of a if it bleeds, it leads kind of thing, you know, like it grabs people's attention. And this whole poverty porn agenda is very big among the right-wing media these days.
Yeah, it is such a easy and cheap shot to demonize homeless people, and especially through using pictures where, you know, people are being shown at some of the roughest times of their lives, times where they are really struggling to get by. And I can imagine that none of those people who've taken those photos or people that write these kinds of articles would want somebody to take a picture of them on a day that they were really struggling. Now, the Homeless Persons Union has written to the Australian Press Council asking that it adopts the Council to Homeless Persons Media Messaging Guide into its advisory guidelines. But what effect would this have? And do you think that media organisations should also consider individually adopting the guide?
Yes, absolutely. So the Australian Press Council already has several advisory guidelines on how to report on other topics vulnerable to stigmatising coverage, so such as family violence or LGBTIQA plus issues. So we were quite shocked to find that they had no equivalent for reporting on homelessness. And our advice is for all media organisations to adopt the media messaging guide created by Council of Homeless Persons, which is a great, easy-to-use resource, provides excellent advice on journalists on how to report on homelessness respectfully. And this is messaging that's already been developed. So this is not an onerous ask for media organisation. This is information and resources that have already been collated. They're already there. So we're just asking them to adopt them. And we think that would go a long way to ensuring those experiencing homelessness are treated with the care and compassion they deserve, and that conversations about homelessness are rooted in facts and not harmful stereotypes.
Absolutely. And with those guidelines in place, does that then enable the Australian Press Council to take action when people contravene the guidelines?
Yes, that is the hope. We did write to the Australian Press Council following the article. It's obviously, we were quite shocked about the language and the photos. And we did sort of identify that the article itself breached two separate guidelines that are meant to be upheld by publications. But unfortunately, they responded to advise that while they'll let the publisher know about our complaint, that they wouldn't actually be proceeding with the complaint, as we were classed as a secondary complainant rather than the person actually identified in the article. So there's a gap there, because that actually means we can't appeal that decision. And so our hope is that, one, that they adopt the media messaging guide to, you know, lift the standard of journalism, but also is that they need to hold these publications accountable when they don't meet those expectations.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've said that you've spoken with the Australian Press Council, and so you're still at that process of urging them to adopt the guidelines. But correct. I know that in the statement you also invited Steve Price to have a conversation about the impacts of his language on people who are homeless. Have you heard from him?
No, but I wrote him a really nice letter twice, and I mean, I didn't want to go the full attack with Steve Price, because nobody really kind of wants to be attacked. So we really genuinely did want to invite him to a conversation and address some of the points that he's raised in his article. The fact that he called the scene a urine stinking homeless camp. Now, the fact of the matter is, Steve, you know, you can't prove why that is the case. It could be men walking out of pubs and peeing in the street. There's such a lack of public toilets in the CBD. Like, that's a real policy issue right there. So, hey, let's have a talk about it, mate. You know, let's discuss these things together. But no, unfortunately, we haven't heard from him, and we've reached out twice. So that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is a shame that he's not willing to engage, or hasn't yet expressed a willingness to engage. I do want to note, and maybe touching back, Kelly, on something that you mentioned at the start about the different kinds of representations of homelessness. Price's comments do represent maybe the worst extent of derogatory language used against homeless people. But we also know that this can be echoed in softer terms or more evasive terms by a broad range of commentators. And I'm just thinking, you know, the sentiments that he expressed in that opinion piece seem to reflect precisely the type of justification that's been used by the City of Melbourne in pushing its anti-homeless patrols, you know, around antisocial behaviour and inappropriate, you know, presentation and whatever in the street, and other local governments as well, the City of Port Phillip, the City of Maribyrnong. So turning to HPU's campaign against that program in solidarity with other campaigns, can you share any updates or reflections on how these media discourses relate to these policies?
Yeah, absolutely. So the City of Melbourne, just to give the listeners a bit of a background, they have employed their own so-called community safety officers, which is just their fancy terminology for security guards. And despite credible reports of harm caused by these security guards towards folks sleeping rough in the CBD, there was no evidence that community perceptions of safety had improved, and there was strong community opposition. City of Melbourne went ahead and doubled the program anyway. And we're quite concerned about the human rights implications of the security guard program towards those sleeping rough. So council has an obligation as a public authority to uphold people's human rights, but they have not done so thus far. So they published a half-completed human rights compatibility assessment. We've highlighted that to them, that that's really legally risky way to run things. And then, you know, in response to that, they've said, oh, we've done another assessment, and they've publicly said that they would publish it at the budget meeting. But 2 months on, they have not published that at all. So I guess in response, Homeless Persons Union Victoria, we're in the process of creating a complaints program to support rough sleepers in the CBD to complain about the security guards and local law officers taking their stuff and treating them poorly and so on. But I guess, and we're obviously happy to do that work because we think that councils need to be held accountable for their actions. But I think the broader message is that we wouldn't actually have to do this work if City of Melbourne would just be committed to upholding everyone's human rights and not just those with influence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kelly, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I'm tongue tied. Danny handled it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it is, an incredible piece of work that you're doing, but as you said, work that has only become necessary because of a difference in the way that the council has chosen to treat homeless people in the CBD versus other people that use that space, because everybody has the same right to be able to access that space, but it is a particular segment of the population that are targeted for doing so. So I guess we'll wrap up there. And I just want to thank you both very much for taking the time to speak with us. Good luck with the Press Council push. And yeah, we'll be looking forward to having you back on again soon.
Thanks, Priya.
Thanks, Priya.
And you are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria speaking about the group's recent publication of a jointly authored statement alongside some of Victoria's leading health and justice organisations that urges the Australian Press Council to adopt the Council to Homeless Persons Media Messaging Guide as an advisory guideline to inform a better standard of reporting on homelessness in Victoria. Now, we are coming up to the very end of our show. So, Kate, do you want to do a quick rundown with me?
Yes, of course. So first, you heard a conversation from the Saturday 25th of July that Leela had with Yaran Cousins Bundle about the process of grounding back in Jabiroong country after visiting Mpwantwe Desert Country the week before to stand in solidarity with Auntie Facility and the Hayes family, demanding sacred Arante land back at the Pine Gap Convergence. After that, we spoke with Rodrigo Acuña, a Spanish teacher, documentary filmmaker and independent specialist in Latin American affairs, about his time spent at the Independent and Peaceful Australian Network's national conference that was themed Time to Break Free from the US.
And then after that, we were joined by Tom Cooper, chair of the 44 Flats United 150 Inkerman Street Residents Committee, who talked with us about an action that's been planned by residents across at least four of the older persons' high-rise public housing buildings to take their concerns about the planned demolition of their homes to the Office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos next Wednesday, the 5th of August at 1 p.m. at number 1 Spring Street, and everyone is encouraged to come along.
Following, we spoke with Chris Christoforou, CEO of VADA, about their campaign and initiatives that they would like to see as we approach state elections. We considered current alcohol and drug treatment services that are available, and also spoke about evidence-based policies and a prioritisation to a health-led approach that could fill some gaps within Victorian government's current drug and alcohol strategy. Now, this conversation touched on drug and alcohol use. If you or anyone you know needs support, contact the National Hotline for confidential counselling and referral on 1800 250 015.
And then finally, as you just heard, we were joined by Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria to talk about media and reporting standards on homelessness and urging the Australian Press Council to adopt ethical guidelines for journalists and commentators in the wake of a pretty derogatory opinion piece published in the Herald Sun. That's all we've got time for today, but stay tuned for Lost in Science, and we will catch you again next week. Bye!
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.